Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, weekly program devoted to the jobs, the money, the income, the debts, all of the economic dimensions of our lives, our children's prospects, all that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. Before jumping into the updates for today, I want to remind you all that this weekly program is a project of a sizable group of people, and if you want to get an idea of who we are and what we do, we maintain these two websites that are designed to provide you, at no cost of course, at 24/7 whenever it's convenient for you, access to all of the work we do. The first website is R.D. Wolff, that's me, two F's, rdwolff.com, and the other one is Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info, I-N-F-O. Okay, let's begin with some economic updates of important subjects, but that we will treat in a short amount of time. China. China looms larger in the world economy, literally, with every passing day. It's frightening to some people, exciting to others, but it's something we have to come to terms with. Many of you have written to me and asked me to talk about it, so I'm going to be doing that more. But let me start off with a kind of shadow over all this conversation. The shadow can best be summarized by quoting from President Obama's 2015 State of the Union address. I'm going to quote now. China wants to write the rules for the world's fastest growing region. He meant Asia. Why should we let that happen? Asks President Obama. We should write those rules. Well, whatever you think about the United States arrogating to itself such a role, in the words of its president, the hard reality is that the United States is no longer in a position to do that. However wistful Mr. Obama's hope to the contrary. Let me give you some ideas of the scope of what we're talking about. On the 30th of November last year, the International Monetary Fund announced that the Chinese currency, called either the renminbi, it's usually abbreviated with the capital letters RMB, the renminbi or the yuan, would soon be included in the basket of currencies that are the dominant major currencies in the world. And those are the US dollar, the euro, the British pound, and the Japanese yen. This is an enormously important, symbolic, but also real arrival of China as a major world economic power. Another statistic. Since the launch in 2009 of a pilot program to settle trade agreements in Asia in their own currency, in the Chinese currency, the share of Chinese trade settled in their own currency, not as they used to do in dollars, went from 3.2% to 25%. That's in 6 or 7 years. That's amazing. China's share of the total output of the world GDP in something called purchasing power parity. It's one of several ways of measuring and comparing GDPs from one country to another, GDP standing for gross domestic product, has risen in 40 years from less than 2% of world production to 16%. China produces 1/6 of the world's output. It's extraordinary. Average per capita, how much output per person, is now expected to increase within a few years from $10,000 to $16,000 in dollars. In 1980, it was $250. Let me say that again. 1980, the per capita output was $250. By the end of by 2020, it'll be $16,000. There are few examples in the history of the world of economic growth as rapid, as sustained for that many years as China is. It is now a major power. At the end of last year, we saw a number of symbolic meetings where something called the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank was established. That is China's baby and is meant to be the counterweight to the Japanese-led Asian Development Bank and the World Bank. And it has almost as much money that it will be using to develop the world in the ways it thinks should be done, so that that is no longer monopolized by the World Bank, which used to do it in the name basically of Europe and America. Then the Japanese wanted to get in on it. Now the Chinese do. What is my point? China has to be dealt with, has to be understood that it is an economic powerhouse. It has accomplished that in literally 30 to 35 years. It is extraordinary what they have done. And if you remember how poor they were 40 years ago, and if you remember that they are the largest country by population in the world, and if you remember that they were led all this time by a communist government that was a pariah in the minds and in the policies of much of the world, then the achievement they've accomplished is even more impressive. The current collapse in the oil market has been very damaging to Russia, to Venezuela, to Nigeria, to the Middle Eastern countries that depend on oil. China is not a major oil producer, it's a major oil consumer, so it has not been hurt in anything like that way as these other countries have, and that gives China yet more leverage, relative strength. China has arrived, and it's a problem for the rest of the world if it keeps pretending that that hasn't happened and isn't a major issue to deal with. Next item, equally important. Drugs. There have been recent reports in the United States, quite a few, of a shortage of drugs. For example, the New York Times on the 29th of January had a long story with the following headline: drug shortages forcing hard decisions on rationing treatments. This was a long story by Sherry Fink, based in Cleveland. And Sherry Fink interviewed a lot of doctors in a lot of different places and discovered, I found this shocking, that drug shortages are endemic. They happen all the time. And these are drugs often for minor aches and pains, but also for major diseases, cancers particularly. And when these shortages show up, and they show up often, doctors and hospitals are put in what they call extremely difficult situations. Difficult ethically, difficult morally. Why? Because if you've got more sick people than you have drugs to deal with those sick people, you suddenly have a terrible decision you have to make. Namely, who gets the medicine and who doesn't? Who waits? Maybe never to get it. Maybe never to get it in time before the disease becomes much worse or death arrives. These are life and death decisions as well as health decisions. What's going on? Well, I'm an economist. I'm looking at the economics of this. Otherwise, I would talk a lot about the moral dilemma here, which is painful for the doctors and terribly dangerous for the public. What I want to do